period or menstrual cycle begins 2 hours or a few hours just before the Maghrib prayers while she's fasting, will her fast be null and void for that fasting day?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because a lot of ladies happen to have this problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they observe fast in the morning, and later to their in the evening, to their surprise, they find blood, and they come to know that okay, they have their menses have just started. Of course, their fast becomes wide, even if it is 1 minute before the iftar time or before the maghrib time. So they cannot make niyyah fasting, because fasting is haram for someone who is menstruating. So they should break their fast and eat something. Okay, if they are, even if they do not eat anything, fasting is wide. She's not to blame if she eats something. She can eat, and of course, everybody understands in the family that, okay, every woman is has menses, and she can eat without having to shy or feel embarrassed eating something.
All right. What rule, Sheikh Javid, applies to someone who immerses themselves in water wearing waterproof clothing, such as a diving suit, which does not allow the body to become wet and it's not penetrable?
Well, according to the fatwa of His Eminence, as I read actually, I would like to actually read the same fatwa without having to change anything. This is the exact fatwa which I'm going to read. His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says in his Ajwabatul Istifta'at, if their clothing has close contact with his head, it is problematic. It means it's a matter of objection. It is problematic to say his fast is valid. Hence, as an obligatory precaution he should perform, it is qadha. So this is the answer he has given. His Eminence has given on with regards to someone immersing himself underwater wearing a waterproof clothing.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you give me hope, deliver this gift right to my home. Marhab, marhab, ya Ramadan, ahi qulubana bil Qur'an.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We're still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the blessed month of Ramadan. Sheikh Javid, is it permitted for a person to travel intentionally, on purpose, during the month of Ramadan in order to break the fast and evade fasting?
Well, there's no problem in doing that, even in order to evade fasting. Of course, it's better not to travel except for a good or necessary purpose. However, when traveling, even in order to evade the duty of fasting, one must actually break the fast, because as long as you are traveling, you cannot observe fast. So no matter what the intention, maybe you are traveling in order to get something done on a journey, or maybe your intention is to evade fasting, there's no problem. Some people suffer from some kind of, dehydration problem, diabetes, or maybe other issues. They prefer traveling during this month, and in order not to fast, that's okay. He cannot fast as long as he is traveling.
Mm-hmm, I see. Well, a person responsible for performing an obligatory fast, this individual decided to fulfill his duty but could not do so because of unforeseen circumstances.
Sure.
For example, they prepare to travel after sunrise. He traveled but failed to return home before noon. He had not done anything that invalidates the fast, except that the time for making the intention of an obligatory fast has elapsed or eluded his mind. And that day is one in which fasting is mustahab or recommended. Is it valid if he makes the intention to perform a recommended fast?
Well, it's very much clear that as long as one has qada fast, he cannot make niyyah for a mustahab fast.
Yes.
Like, for example, the 15th of Shaban is a good day to observe fast, okay?
Yes.
Or any other, there are many days on which fasting is recommended. You have qada fast, you have mustahab fast. You cannot make one niyyah, you cannot fast with two intentions. Meaning that you cannot observe with the intention of qada fast and at the same time with the intention of observing a mustahab fast. So you can observe one fast. And that is the qada fast, not mustahab fast. As long as you have qada fast, you cannot observe mustahab fast. That's for sure.
Thank you. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And share with our guest speaker, we are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and also fasting. Sheikh Javid, we know that some people are addicted to smoking. And, this is sort of an epidemic here and there. No matter how much they try not to be irritable in this month, I mean, blessed month of Ramadan, they cannot abstain from conduct that disrupts the peace of their family and puts them into a nervous state. So what is their duty in this situation?
Well, it is obligatory for him to fast in the month of Ramadan, even though he is addicted to fasting. There are a lot of people who are addicted. And this month of Ramadan provides a very good opportunity for people who are addicted to smoking. They can actually quit smoking by fasting. I have seen a lot of people who actually made use of this opportunity to quit smoking, which is obviously very injurious to one's health. Now, when it comes to smoking while fasting, His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei is of the view that smoking is not permissible as a measure of obligatory precaution.
Mm-hmm.
So this is actually ihtiyat, this precaution. And I've seen many other scholars who are of the view that actually smoking is not permissible as a measure of obligatory precaution. They also observe precaution. And there are also some scholars who forbid smoking no matter what, no matter you are fasting or you are not fasting. So you just said that actually there are some people who becomes very much
addicted.
They become irritable.
Uh-huh.
They become angry if they do not smoke.
They become grumpy when they don't smoke.
That's not an excuse actually. he should treat others properly, and not smoking doesn't mean he should treat others harshly without any justification.
Sheikh Javid, maybe I should have asked you first this question. Is smoking a genuine invalidator of fasting?
The scholars, as I said, does not permit smoking as a measure of obligatory precaution. So there's
all of ihtiyat. Them are of the same view.
Ayatollah Sistani is of the same view. His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei is of the same view that smoking, and even many other scholars I know, I don't want to mention their names, they are also of the view that it invalidates the fast as a measure of obligatory precaution. And to smoke openly in public,
yes,
it's a kind of disregard to the month of Ramadan. Eating,
and
drinking,
majority of Muslims.
And unfortunately, we do see some people having no.
What about non-narcotics?
It's absolutely forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's no doubt about it.
Doesn't it matter if the smoke is thin or thick?
The smoke is always supposed to be
thick.
Thick,
right?
Yes.
But if they claim that, for example, this is smoke is thinner than normal, it doesn't invalidate the fasting. Do you agree?
No, I don't agree. I'm speaking on behalf of a religious authority.
Right.
The same obligatory precaution is there. Okay, if they want to satiate that kind of, let's say, thirst for smoking, they can use a patch.
Right.
This is a kind of narcotic patch,
yes,
or something. They can use it.
What about vaping? This electronic or electric type of new invention that came out into
again,
the market.
Again, there is smoke.
Even there is smoke coming out.
There is smoke coming out.
But it's not the natural smoke of cigarettes.
Yeah, it's not the natural. It is mixed with some kind of steam.
Yes.
Steam going into the throat.
Right.
And that's even more problematic.
Uh-huh, I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad. That's the host of this program. We bid you farewell, and wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Oh Allah, please unite us and guide us to paradise. Oh, and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show.
Iranian weapon. Part 2.
Iran's defense industry experts have a big concern. Are they able to quickly protect the country against such air raids? These systems and machines are all manufactured and produced either by the US or UK. The range of their missiles is very limited, and their radars are hard to repair. But for now, all of Iran's defense capacity is restricted to such facilities, and the country has to advance its scientific potentials as well. The Rapier and Hawk systems. Rapier is a British short-range surface-to-air missile launcher, and Hawk was an American medium-range surface-to-air missile system. Iran had purchased them before the revolution. The missiles barely reached the required range to hit Iraqi fighter jets during the war.
Fire.
Now, these are Iran's only tools to fend off a possible attack by countries like the U.S. Of course, Iran had also bought a type of air defense system from the country where this man's pictures were painted on its walls, from Libya. During a symbolic parade, the systems are loaded for delivery to Iran, but they were not made by Libya. The Soviets had built them and named them SAM-2 and sold them to Libya. However, after SAM-2 was imported to Iran, it immediately stopped working after Libya's support was terminated. Gaddafi had decided to join the club of Saddam supporters. Now, Iran must have launched and repaired the systems by itself. Thus, Iran was coerced to reverse engineer foreign radars and build the first national radar at home. In 1983, the U.S. invaded Iraq, and Iran must quickly acquire the systems that will put the entire country under a dome of protective waves. Iran is going to buy the SAM-5 from Russia. Russia's S-200 or SAM-5 eventually joins the Iranian army. SAM-5 is also handed over to the defense industry for study. Research on the concept of radar had been started for a long time and continued. Men and women came to work on the plan from all universities in the country. For the first time in its history, Iran wants to completely entrust its military needs to young students. The Mehrsad air system is the result of the trust. Mehrsad means ambush. The Iranian ambush is an example of the reverse engineering of the American Hawk. The first step to conquer the sky step by step. This is 2010. The Mehrsads launched their missiles one after the other. The missiles are called Shaheen and are domestically produced by Iran. The missile control room is also domestically produced. This is an important secret. This room is the big secret of Iranians. Without having information about it, it's impossible for the enemy to easily disable it. In today's world, if the defense systems are not indigenous, the fate of Iraq will repeat itself, and Iran is aware of this very well. The Mehrsad missiles were quickly updated. Mehrsad 1, 2, and 3. The Mehrsad air defense system consisted of three main components: missile and launcher, detection radar, and engagement radar, all of which in the initial versions were reverse engineered from the American Hawk air defense system. This system is of medium range, and its operational range has been calculated to be up to 40 kilometers. But it's not meant to stop there. The Shaheen missile quickly turns into Shalamche with a speed of about 4 times the speed of sound. Shalamche can hit any target at an altitude of 18 kilometers. This means Iran is gradually approaching the highest altitude. The firing of Shalamche from the Mersad systems leads the then defense minister to respond to the U.S. claims. They claim to have the ability to attack Iran. Iran has an important theory called the defense dome. However, the defense dome has many needs that cannot be met by the Shalamche system alone. It requires special radars that can withstand the electronic warfare of the major powers. Perhaps something on the level of American air defense systems. But this is a big claim. American fighter jets fly at high altitudes and they cannot be detected with ordinary radars. Will Iran build its own defense dome? In the 2010s, the country enters a new era, in which the turmoil of sanctions will reach its peak, and it's the economic issues that will attract more attention than the military ones. In 2013, the United Nations Security Council imposed sanctions on Iran based on a proposal by the U.S. and its Western allies. One of the branches of the embargo is the purchase of weapons. It means Iran will soon face an important challenge regarding one of its purchases, the S-300.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shah.
When we say Divan of Hafiz is a book of Irfan,
Maulavi claims that this Masnavi Ma'navi is the interpretation of the Quran.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the religious and scholarly life of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite dignitaries, ulama and scholars all across the world of Islam during the history of Islam. For today's discussion, I have two very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sheikh Fadai. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Fadai, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about the life of an alim, a faqih, and a muhaddis of the 13th century Hijra, Sayyid Abdullah Shubbar, mainly known as Al-Majlisi As-Sani. Sheikh Rouhani, first give us some details about the early life and biography of Sayyid Abdullah Shubbar.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Sayyid Abdullah ibn Sayyid Muhammad Rida Shubbar Husayni Najafi Kazimi. This is the full name of this great scholar who lived in the 13th century of Qamari calendar. He was among the great Shiite scholars in that century, and he is among the trustworthy kind of narrators and transmitters of hadith of the Imamiyya. And of course, he wrote many tafasir interpretation on the ayat of the Holy Quran as well, and he was born in Najaf al-Ashraf. Then he moved to Kadhimayn and lived there for the rest of his life. And of course, he is known as Majlisi al-Thani because of his great works and books that he compiled in the history of the Shayyu.
Yes.
Of course, he is Najafi, but he was buried, I think, in Kadhimayn. And that's why
He is, of course, among the well-known Shiite scholars and narrators and mufassir of the Holy Quran.
That's all right. Okay. Sheikh Fanai Sayyid Abdullah Shobar is known as a prolific writer, a person who writes a lot. That's why the Majlis Yassani, the title is given to him, a person who has so many compilations and authored many books. Just give us some details about the scholarly life, or it's better to say academic life, of Sayyid Abdullah Shobar. Then we'll get to more details of his life. For instance, his ideas regarding Usuli and Akhbari dialects.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid Abdullah Shobar was born in Najaf, but he went to Qazimain and had his scholarly life in that city, I mean Qazimain. And yes, as you mentioned, he had a lot of works, scholarly works, and it is recorded that he had more than 70 books.
Yes.
And articles, and one of the reasons that he could have this success was the speed of his writing. Mm-hmm. He was known and famous for the speed of writing and, of course, for his great memory.
Yes.
He has mentioned that he had a very good memory, and sometimes he could write an article in one night.
Mm-hmm.
And once he was asked about this potential, and he answered that I got this from Imam Kazim alayhi salam.
Okay.
It means by tawassul and the ziyarat that he had. It was a special blessing from Imam Kazim that he could write very fast and he had very great memory and mm-hmm. he could write a lot of books. But it doesn't mean that just this alim, this scholar, had a lot of works. As you mentioned, he was known as Majlisi al-Sani.
Yes.
It means that he was like Allama Majlisi.
Yes.
Because of his various works. A lot of scholars, Shiite scholars, had various books. And this was a process in Hosea
mm-hmm.
that after several years
yes.
that you are just students, you have to be a teacher, you have to be an yes. author.
Yes.
And
it was like something like a thesis or dissertation at yes. the university in today's world, isn't
yes.
it?
But you know, okay. nowadays in Hosea and university, they only if you are forced to write, for mm-hmm. example, because yes. of doctoral thesis, I yes. don't know, MA thesis, they write. But if they are not forced for the certificates, they do not attend to writing.
Yes.
But in our traditional Hosea, it was very ordinal mm-hmm. that an Islamic scholar should write.
Yes.
So he had more than 70 books.
Yes.
And as you know, he was not so old. He yes. died at the age of 54.
58, maybe 54. Yes. That's right. Okay.
And if you just think about his youth,
yes.
I know, for example, imagine if you stored their book, his books, in the age of 20.
Yes.
He didn't have a lot of time to write such a books. For example, in the field of interpretation,
yes.
Tafsir al-Quran,
yes.
he had three books,
mm-hmm.
Tafsir al-Kabir, Tafsir al-Wasit, and Tafsir al-Wajiz.
Yes.
And the second one, Tafsir al-Wasit, al-Johar al-Samin,
yes.
is very famous in the Hosea. Because the first one, the Kabir, was not published
uh-huh.
for all people.
So it was authored, but it's not
authored,
published.
Yeah,
that's right.
Okay. So that's a pattern for
yes.
Hosea University to use scholarly life,
mm-hmm.
write a lot. So the future scholars, the future students, they can use from our job.
Mm-hmm. That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And Sheikh Rouhani, he passed in a life that, 13th century Hijra, especially in the cities of Najaf, three important scholarly streams, it's better to say, were active, Akhbari, Usuli, and Falsafi, or philosophical, Usuli and Akhbari. And Sayyid Abdullah Shobar was among the Imamiyah scholars who authored some works on criticizing some of the viewpoints of Akhbaris. First of all, give us this differentiation. Define for us what is exactly Akhbari Usuli and Falsafi look and perspectives regarding Islamic studies.
Yes, of course. As you know, Akhbari, the term Akhbari is rooted in the word khabar,
yes,
which means narration and ahadith. So that is why these Akhbari people or Akhbari scholar are those scholars who just believe that we should refer to, in any details of our life to only to the narrations and ahadiths narrated from the Holy Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam. And we shouldn't perform ijtihad, which is a specific kind of speciality that,
yes,
that the scholars have, the usuli, let's say ulama, perform it to drive actually the ahkam and the, let's say, religious duties of the followers of Islam from the sources, from the main Islamic sources. So that's why when it comes to usuli scholars are of the view that no, only akhbar is not enough. Then a scholar should be a mujtahid, a professional, an expert, let's say, in different fields of his studies, and particularly in logic, in, yes, ilm al-usul, in, to some extent, in philosophy even.
Yes.
In different kind of fields of study, he must be specialized and, let's say, scholarly figure and history, for example. So then he will be able to understand, for example, that a specific riwayah, that a specific hukm of Islam, is it adaptable, for example, for nowadays life or not? How should we perform it? How should we follow it? If we just directly refer to the riwayat and ahadith, because some of these riwayats are for a specific kind of condition,
yes,
situation, we cannot apply it for always, for example, to tell the Muslims that you have to fulfill all of them, these things, let's say, in your lives. So that's why these akhbaris just rely on the akhbar, but usulis relies on ijtihad,
yes,
which is which means that they refer to Quran, ayat of the Holy Quran, to the akhbar, ahadith,
yes,
as well as aql. They refer to aql and they refer to ijma, the other, let's say, consensus among the scholars, for example.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things should be applied in order to get the true hukm of Islam.
Yes.
Yeah, this is the main difference between akhbari and usuli. They had actually conflict for many centuries, particularly in this century that Sayyid Shubbar lived.
That's right.
That was also the century.
And Sayyid Shubbar was a criticizer of the akhbari, yes, perspective and outlook on that time. That's all right. But Sheikh Fadai, there's still a third perspective, and that is philosophical one. I mean, the Akhbari one and the Usuli ones were explained by Sheikh Rouhani, and this philosophical one. Can we say that, for example, the philosophical and the Akhbari are two radical extremes of same pole, and Usuli one is somehow the middle one? I mean, the rational one and the middle one, or not?
You know what? Akhbari and Usuli are two opposite sides.
Okay.
But the philosophical side, we cannot say that this is the third one that, mm-hmm, doesn't accept the other two.
Yes.
No, nowadays we have a lot of scholars. They are usuli and philosopher.
Yes.
But in the field of akhbari, you know, the akhbari scholars, usually they do not accept philosophy. You know, usuli scholars don't have any problem with philosophy. Mm-hmm. Some of them accept and some may. You know, because in akhbari, they, as my brother mentioned, they believe that the only source of religion is riwayat.
Yes.
Not ijtihad and not philosophy. You know, in ijtihad, you refer to Quran, to hadith, and your aql.
Yes.
And in philosophy, usually, mostly, you refer to the aql. Of,
yes,
course, we have the school of Hikmat Muta'aliyah,
yes,
which is the combination of Quran, Rivayat, and aql. Mainly, the problem is about Akhbari school of thought. You know, the problem is that in Akhbari school of thought, they usually oppose, mm-hmm, the usage of ration,
yes,
and aql.
Yes.
And this is the first problem. The first problem is that our religion doesn't oppose the aql.
Mm-hmm.
If aql was useless, so why did God create that?
Yes.
And why are we ordered to use that a lot, even in Quran? We have a lot of order about tadabbur. Tadabbur means to use your aql. This is the first problem. If you want to close the door, the gates of aql and ration, this is yes. not what our religion
yes.
Asks us. The second problem is that even about akhbar means riwayat and hadith, usually they don't care about the source of riwayat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, akhbari scholars used to accept everything which was called riwayat.
That's right.
And they were not careful about the source of riwayat. You know, I want to quote a sentence from Ayatollah Ma'rifat, which is one of the most important yes. scholars in Quran and hadith. He said in the book Siyanat al-Quran min al-Tahrif, he said that the problem that akhbari scholars made for Islam is not smaller than the problem that Khawarij made for Islam.
Uh-huh.
You know why? Because if when you don't care about the source of riwayah and you gather everything called mm-hmm. riwayah,
yes.
so here in the combined riwayahs
yes.
that you gather,
yes.
there may have been a lot of problem, you know, which ja'li riwayahs,
yes.
fake riwayahs,
yes.
Which mainly was forged in order to destroy Islam.
Yes.
And they gather
the true
that
face of Ahl al-Bayt sometimes.
But
that's
some
right.
scholars like Sayyid Abdullah Shubat, they yes. try to clarify that this is not correct school of thought,
mm-hmm.
to gather riwayat without caring about this source. You know, when we say usuli doesn't mean that they do not accept riwayat. Our mujtahids nowadays, they use riwayat.
That's right.
But how to use? We have three sciences, Rijal, Diraya, and Fiqh al-Hadith.
Yes.
After these filters, you can use Ruwaya.
Yes, that's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration. Because as we said, Sayyid Abdullah Shubar was a prolific writer. His books reached also the world of our Sunni scholar. That's why so many of the Sunni scholars and ulama admired his works, including, for example, Muhammad Hussein al-Zahabi and also Hamad al-Hanafi from the University of Al-Azhar in Egypt, you know, that they talked in admiration of the multitude of the actions and the works and the, especially say, writings and compilations of Sayyid Abdullah al-Shubar. The year 1242, according to the Hijri calendar, is the year in which Sayyid Abdullah al-Shubar passed away. His body was taken into city of Al-Kazamiya and he was buried in the holy courtyard of Al-Kazamiya. May Allah bless the soul of this prolific writer, Sayyid Abdullah Shubba. Thank you, my Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani.
You're welcome.
For your nice elaboration regarding his life. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
On behalf of myself and all of my
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam
is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
رسول خدا فرمود لا یقعد علیها الا الصائمون.
The Holy Prophet of Islam stated, no one can taste the sweetness of the banquet of Ramadan except those who fast during this month. This is the banquet that no one has ever tasted, experienced, or witnessed. The holy month of Ramadan is like a party whose host is Allah and we are the guests. Also, this banquet is filled with many spiritual foods and drinks which are prepared by Allah Himself. The holy month of Ramadan is like a big banquet, and we must try our best to benefit the most from it. If we do not find a chance to consume from this banquet, or we lose the chances, we are in fact depriving ourselves from many blessings of Allah. Ramadan is like a big circle that includes many bounties and blessings. It is our shortcoming if we cannot enjoy the spiritual food and blessings of this month. In better words, the holy month of Ramadan is like a big party that different people are invited to. The more they enjoy this party, the more they will be prosperous during this month. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
En respuesta a...
In response to the countries and the nations who dare to take their destiny in their own hands, to self-government, to self-determination, to simply be independent,
a simplemente ser independientes,
the imperialist forces and the imperialist countries take different measures. One of the most perverse measures are the blockades and sanctions, particularly those exercised by the United States, also by Western Europe, and sometimes even by some international organizations, such as the United Nations. Beware. The main function of these blockades is to try to complicate the life to the inhabitants of the countries with whom they have contradictions and want them to change their way of thought, government, and administration. Because it seems that freedom, free trade, and self-determination does not exist for them. Of course, it doesn't exist. And they immediately take measures that in some cases have resulted in very serious issues in nutrition, medicine, and the most essential elements in some countries. That is to say, who is ultimately punished is the people who receive the sanctions.
Los gobiernos que han sido sancionados,
the governments that have been constantly sanctioned have become stronger in relation to their population.
Ya han cambiado el modelo de desarrollo,
and have changed the development model in such a way that as the great Chinese leader and founder of the People's Republic of China, Mao Zedong, said, the reactionaries lift the rock in their hands to such an extent that when they hold it up, it falls off on their own feet, and the sanctions become something negative for those who have imposed them.
Y se convierten las sanciones en algo negativo para quienes la han llevado adelante. Así tenemos, por ejemplo, que...
Thus, for example, among 17 sanctioned countries with the highest number of sanctioned companies, individuals, and private entities,
particulares,
some have been strengthened to such a level, as is the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, which has had sanctions since 1950. The Republic of Cuba, which has had sanctions since 1960, and almost total since 1962, and the Islamic Republic of Iran since
1979.
Well, we also have Venezuela, where we have Venezuela today that is satisfying almost 90% of its food consumption through internal production, something that has never been in history. The sanctioned countries, Nicaragua and Russia, strengthen their internal construction, their internal market, their internal industry, in such a way that they advance scientifically and militarily, deepening their independence and sovereignty, which has been a setback for imperialism. It is true that a cost that had to be paid. And that affects the people, all the inhabitants of the country that is sanctioned. It is the madness of imperialism, that fanatic thing of subduing others through hunger. This is what the gringos and North Americans do. This is what the Americans do. But it goes against them. Today, in the Gaza Strip, Gazans are the most sanctioned on the planet. There, not even medicines, water, or anything else is allowed to enter. Zionism and its godfather, North American imperialism, are the ones leading it. The people are wise. They persevere on the path of independence and sovereignty. The sanctions have proven to be a fiasco at the end of the day. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes. Hoy, para hablar desde sanciones y bloqueos,
Today, we have a guest from Italy to talk about sanctions and blockade by imperialist powers against nations, governments, and countries.
Fabrizio Casari,
Italian journalist and international analyst, expert in analyzing economic sanctions and punitive measures applied by capitalist powers against nations. Fabrizio Casari, welcome to Black and White.
Thank you for your invitation. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Fabrizio, ubiquémonos en nuestra época desde el punto de vista contemporáneo.
At the current historical stage, what are the goals, consequences, and manifestations of these policies and sanctions by the imperialist powers?
De sanciones y bloqueos por parte de las potencias imperialistas.
La política de bloqueo y de sanciones es parte de...
The policy of blockade and sanctions is called the fourth and fifth generation war, depending on who brings it up. The modern war, which the unipolar world starts, is to simply prevent the world from becoming multipolar. In order to prevent the loss of its hegemonic role as a group, the West is increasingly using all the tools of the fifth generation war, that is, diplomacy, politics, and above all, the media and sanctions, which are the tools of this war. Sanctions today affect 17 countries with specific and selective measures and 6 countries with general measures. We must note that the type of these actions can be general or targeted at individuals. Therefore, a total of 23 countries have been targeted by unilateral, illegitimate, and illegal sanctions. We are talking about 72% of the world's population and more than 30% of the entire world's GDP. I said this to understand the size and the scope of this action. Sanctions, on the other hand, result from a clear but unfair desire to win a competition, competing with products and markets. When you ban the export of a country's products and when you have the same product, you will be the only option for purchase. Furthermore, when you prevent a country from using the international transaction withdrawal system, things get more complicated. The effect of this action is not only on your target country, but also on all countries that want to do business with it. This gets even more complicated when you block a country from accessing SWIFT transactions and also block it from using the dollar currency. When a country is sanctioned, the only option left is to buy Western goods. With these conditions, the West keeps its economy in a state of addiction and says that it is the best and biggest economy. But no, the reason is sanctions. As I told you, sanctions are not a substitute for war. Many times you are told that sanctions are a substitute for war. This is a lie. Sanctions are the art of war. This should be clarified. In the following, we will see their dire goals.
Entonces esto habría que quedarlo claro, claro. Y vamos a ver después cuáles son sus objetivos finales, ¿no?
Así es. Las sanciones son parte de la guerra. Ahora bien, ¿cómo los pueblos?
Yes, that's right. Sanctions are part of the war. Now, according to the current situation that we are witnessing, the situation has changed. As we know, we see American countries that have stood up for their rights, and how the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has strengthened in science and the military sector, etc. And Venezuela has made an incredible progress in food production. And Iran has solved a series of issues in the food security sector and has made progress in the scientific and military fields. And also in the case of Russia, it seems that the sanctions have had the opposite effect.
La propia Rusia, ¿no es cierto? Pareciera ser que el efecto fue al revés, ¿no? Es decir, hoy día...
Is there a case today that sanctions have been able to achieve the goal of overthrowing a government and changing the direction of a country?
A un gobierno a cambiar la orientación de ese estado?
Jamás, ni uno.
Never, not a single one. There is no country in the world that has been overthrown due to Western sanctions. When I say Western sanctions, it is actually an implicit meaning that means U.S. sanctions. And then the rest of the West also follows these sanctions, but they're not the ones who impose the sanctions. I mean specifically the European Union. EU sanctions are ridiculous. For example, it's funny when Latin American countries like Nicaragua is sanctioned because Europe's trade relations with Nicaragua are very small. What does Nicaragua lose when sanctioned? What we see is that the ultimate goal of sanctions is to topple governments. Who are these sanctions against? Against all governments that do not submit their political sovereignty, resources, and political identity to the West, or in fact America. Countries that believe that they have the right to choose their own government, as well as the right to choose the government's program, goals, and international stance, are considered enemies. How do they become enemies? A campaign is started which almost always says that those countries are violating human rights.
Se comienza la campaña diciendo que esos países casi siempre, siempre violan los derechos humanos.
Ahí vamos a quedar.
We will take a break for a few moments and then continue the second part with Fabrizio Casari.
Volvemos, estamos acá con Fabrizio Casari.
Back here we are with Fabrizio Casari. The discussion is about embargo and blockade. You were giving reasons for your own explanations. Go ahead, Fabrizio, please.
Adelante, por favor, Fabrizio.
Y lo que decía es que no haya habido ni un gobierno en el mundo.
Yes, I was saying that there is not a single government in the world that has been overthrown due to the sanctions of the United States and the West. And there is no government that will fall because of this in the future. This is a zero-sum game, and when despite the efforts of America and the West, when the desired result is not achieved, it means America's defeat. Sanctions are illegitimate because they have not been declared by any international court or the United Nations, which are the only organizations that have the authority to impose sanctions. These sanctions are illegal because they're not announced by the courts. They are announced by the offices of a ministry, and they are part of the political actions. These sanctions are unfair because the people being sanctioned have nothing to do with the government that may or may not fall. But the reality is that they hit the governments that do not surrender their political sovereignty and resources to America. Governments that do not want to determine their own political line and place in international confrontations in exchange for not being sanctioned. These countries are immediately considered by the U.S. as enemy countries, and then the U.S. says that these countries violate human rights or claim that these countries are declared an extraordinary threat to the security of the U.S. Why do they say this, despite the fact that it is a country 30,000 kilometers away? They say this, and they make management statements about it so that they later commit the most theft of resources based on these words. They must have a political justification for their robberies and looting, otherwise the law of America itself will not allow them to do so. The point is that 72% of the world's population is sanctioned by the other 25%. Can a system like this continue to work? Obviously not. Can almost 30% of the GDP be sanctioned? Because the one who used to have 60% of the production and now this figure doesn't even reach 40% of the world's gross domestic product makes such a decision. These are questions that all lawyers and people with knowledge in the world have. But in addition to sum up this conversation, there's also the boomerang effect of sanctions. What will happen? When some countries are sanctioned, the United States and Europe cannot officially sell those products, and this causes their products to be stockpiled. These products expire. For one, because I remind you again, we are talking about 72% of the world's population, So when you know that you can't do business with 72% of the world's population, you can't sell anything to them. You can't buy anything from them. Your production will only be for 28% of the world's population. This amount is very, very low. So your economy will have very, very little growth.